The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 133, RLDS Women in the Priesthood, the Utah Experience. A panel discussion with moderator William Russell and panelists Deanna Henderson, Lori Heinz, and Nedra Troyer.
Here. For Diana and then Lori and Nedra.
And we speak there and then answer questions here?
Yeah, I speak here and then pass the mic back down there during the question time. As soon as this thing says 11:15, I'm going to start it.
Can we get another cup?
Oh, this is not. I'm not using this.
You're not? Are you sure? No. You don't want any more?
No.
You're welcome to share mine.
A drink out of the pitcher.
I'll just guzzle from the pitcher. Yeah. Never mind.
There's only two clean glasses, so you get the pitcher.
They should bring in new cups, the glasses, but they don't. Well, the timer here says 11:15, and I think that means we're on the tape. So I think we'll go ahead and get started, although I might wait a second till folks get out the door and stuff. So this is the session on the experience of Utah RLDS women in the priesthood. And I'm going to give a little historical introduction, and then the three speakers will speak, and I'll introduce them at the end of that introduction. My name is Bill Russell, and I've been teaching at Grayson College forever and ever. That's the RLDS College in Lamoni, Iowa. 33 years, I think, by my last count. And I've taught religion, history, and political science there. At the April 1984 World Conference of the RLDS Church, the President Prophet Wallace B. Smith presented a controversial revelation, which is now Section 156 in our Doctrine and Covenants. This revelation called for the ordination of women, and also called for building a temple in Independence, which would be dedicated to the pursuit of peace. After a debate that lasted 3 days, the revelation was approved by a vote of the delegates. Observers in the balcony typically estimated the vote at about 80% of the delegates voting in favor and about 20% of the delegates voting against President Smith's proposed revelation. Soon it was decided by the World Church leadership that the first ordinations would take place on November 17, 1985, 18 months after that conference where it was approved. The leaders in Independence no doubt wanted to avoid a contest, you know, who would around the church, including Salt Lake City, where Elsie Kornman and Dana Cochran Wiley were ordained on that day. In many localities, it was months or even years before the first woman was approved and ordained. For the previous 15 years or so before Section 156, there had been quite a bit of debate about a variety of issues within the RLDS Church, with the result of an emerging division of opinion between a faction that we might call fundamentalists or traditionalists, who wanted to keep the doctrine of the Church pretty much unchanged, and a faction of modernizers or ecumenists or liberals, whatever you want to call them, who wanted to give more emphasis to our commonality with Protestantism and less emphasis to our distinct Mormon doctrines. The ordination of women was just one of several issues that had divided the two factions in the years preceding Section 156, but this issue soon became the focal point of the debate. It almost overwhelms the rest of the debate. Within the next 4 years, after 1984, at least 200 local splinter groups were organized in the United States, but none here in Salt Lake City. The people withdrew, or in Utah, period. The people withdrew from involvement in their local RLDS congregations and organized separate local groups in which they sought to preserve the traditional RLDS doctrines and practices they had grown up with. First, I ought to say just a few words about priesthood in the two churches. They have basically the same offices found in Joseph Smith's revelations, you know, deacon, teacher, priest, elder, high priest, and so forth. And I don't think the RLDS DNC references to the duties of these officers are significantly different, maybe not different at all, as is found in the LDS Doctrine and Covenants, you know, because they're basically the same revelations from Joseph Smith Jr. Let me mention some ways I think there are at least subtle differences that have evolved in the two priesthood systems. I think one difference is the fact that in the LDS Church, all worthy boys at 12 are ordained a deacon. And then in the teen years, they progress to the office of teacher and finally to priest in their teen years. And then if the boy remains worthy, he will move into the Melchizedek priesthood and become an elder, typically as he goes on a mission. And then later he may become a high priest and whatever other more advanced offices, you might say. One office that has quite different functions, of course, is the bishop. Your bishop of the ward is what we would call the pastor of the congregation. And our bishop is a financial officer. Another office where some differences exist is in the patriarch or evangelist. The DNC uses both terms, patriarch and evangelist, for this office. With an all-male priesthood, the natural tendency had always been to use the term patriarch, which we had in our church for traditionally used more often. You know, it's more impressive. It conjures up an image of the patriarch of Constantinople or something. I remember once a Methodist seminary professor of mine told me, I've met the leader of your church. And I thought, oh, cool, you met W. Wallace Smith. And from our discussion, it soon was clear he hadn't met W. Wallace Smith. And finally I realized, you've just met my old religion professor, Roy Chaville, from Graceland, who's now the presiding patriarch of the church. But he's not the leader of the church, nor is the presiding bishop the leader of the church, nor is the president of the 12 apostles the leader of the church. But then I explained the system from there. But anyway, we Latter-day Saints have a lot of impressive titles in our system. It seems to me that the most significant difference is the way a person becomes a priesthood member in the two churches. With the LDS, there is a very routine advancement, like I just mentioned, beginning in the three Aaronic orders and on up and then on beyond, if that works out, if the boy remains faithful as an adult. It seems to me that this doesn't have the sense of a unique calling for the teenage boy being ordained when all the other boys, his age are being ordained and so forth. In our system, in order to be in the priesthood, your pastor will have to feel that she or he has evidence that you are specifically called and to a specific office. The latter might be the hard part. The pastor might feel convinced that you're called of God's minister, but not be sure what place, what office that should be, because we don't have this routine system beginning with deacon and moving on up. And so, I feel that Sister So-and-so is called, but to what office? Secondly, you're expected to feel, the person is expected to feel a sense of calling as well. So both the pastor and the person have to have sensed this calling. And then finally, your district or your state conference are going to have to vote on whether they feel you've been called by God to serve in that office. And they might vote no. And that doesn't happen very often, but it has happened in recent years. There are men who have been active in the RLDS Church all their lives, and who are persons who are deemed worthy. They don't smoke or drink or run around with wild women or attend Sunstone or anything terrible like that, and yet still never be called, not even to the Aaronic priesthood. Others may be called to only one office. They may be ordained a deacon or a teacher, a priest, or elder, usually one of those four if they remain in that office the rest of their life, and that's quite legitimate. For example, I was ordained a priest in 1957, and 42 years later, I'm still a priest. Albert Peck here has kiddingly called me an adult Aaronic, as we know. I know that means something in your system, and I'm sure he knows it doesn't bother me, because I've always felt that any ministerial gifts I might have are perfectly legitimately fulfilled in the office of priest. And of course, then a final significant difference is really the focus of today, in the sense that is that since 1985, the RLDS Church has been ordaining women, and so that's part of it too. Okay, political battles ensued over the ordination of women in various stakes and districts after the revelation. In two stakes in the Independence area, the fundamentalists were in the majority and defeated a whole slew of proposed priesthood ordinations in those early days after November 1985. But in practically every jurisdiction, I'm not aware of any to the contrary, virtually always the modernizers finally won and the women were ordained. Here in Utah, there were only a few individuals who dissented, and only a very small handful left the church. One hand would do, I think, for counting the numbers. No fundamental dissenters were able to organize a congregation of dissidents out here. It's my unscientific estimate that in the United States and Canada, at least one half of the persons ordained to the priesthood in the past 14 years are women. In Utah, it's been more than half. I would also estimate that among those who are active in the priesthood, more than a third and possibly a half, somewhere in that range, of the active priesthood members in the Utah area, in what we call the Intermountain District, are women. That composes the congregations at Orem, Salt Lake, Ogden, and Pocatello. In the RLDS Church, no women have been ordained to the first presidency as yet, but we do have two in the Quorum of 12 Apostles, and all the other offices have had women. Here in Utah, women have been particularly prominent in priesthood roles. Our current district president, Bunny Lee from Ogden, is a woman, Each of the four congregations in the Intermountain District have had women pastors in the past 10 years. And at present, two of the four congregations in the district have women pastors. In Salt Lake City, our current pastor is Diana Henderson, who's a panelist today. We'll introduce her more later. This is her second stint as pastor in Salt Lake City. The other congregation that currently has a woman as pastor is Orem, where Norma Hope serves in that capacity. Evangelist Nedra Troyer, on our panel today, has also served as pastor at Orem. In Ogden, Harriet White and Bunny Lee have served as pastor there. In Pocatello, Myrna Lowenthal has been their pastor. In Utah, in addition to the first evangelist, Nedra Troyer, and our district president, Bunny Lee, we have at least 10 women who are elders, and elders typically provide the leadership for our congregations. We also have quite a few women who serve in the Aaronic priesthood. I recall in the RLDS Church, prior to Section 156, when the push was on for women in the priesthood, there was a tendency by the leadership to respond by saying that, well, the wives share the ministry of their husbands, and that was supposed to get us off the hook. It didn't. But anyway, that was a natural defensive reaction to those people who were criticizing the all-male priesthood in the church. But it's my understanding that when, here in Utah, when the television media have reported on the RLDS women in the priesthood, there's been a tendency to regard them as working in a team with their husband or supporting the husband in his ministry. That doesn't wash in the slightest. Because the Utah RLDS women in the priesthood are often not, by any stretch of the imagination, an extension of their husband's ministry. In many cases, the woman is more prominent as a leader in the congregation than her husband. For example, you could hardly say Bunny Lee, his husband, I don't know him, but she's the district president. She's hardly an extension of her husband's priesthood. Certainly those married women who've served as pastor are hardly an extension of the priesthood of their spouse. Some of the women are in the Melchizedek priesthood, while their husbands are in the Aaronic priesthood. Some have non-priesthood husbands, and some have non-member husbands who are in the priesthood. And then some, like Diana Henderson here, are single. So the categories of those who couldn't be conceived as supporting their husband are much greater than the reverse, and the numbers would be greater as well. I've asked the panelists not to sugarcoat their experiences as priesthood in the church in the last 10 or 15 years or so, but to tell us, you know, an honest assessment of how they feel about serving God in their particular capacity. So now let me introduce our three panelists, and they'll speak in the order that I introduced them, even though they're not sitting in that order. On my far right is Diana Henderson, who is an elder and a pastor in the Salt Lake City congregation. She was raised in Omaha, Nebraska, attended high school on the Winnebago Reservation in Nebraska, attended our fine college at Graceland, graduating with a major in theater. She received her master's degree in theater at the University of Nebraska, and then came to Utah to teach theater at the College of Eastern Utah in Price. It was an adjustment, I think, from Omaha to Price, possibly. Later, she moved to Salt Lake City and became the licensed massage therapist. She now teaches at the Utah College of Massage Therapy here in Salt Lake City. Lori Heinz, who's sitting closest to me, was born and raised in Utah and is also a lifelong member of the RLDS Church here in Utah. She also graduated from Graceland College with a degree in business administration. She and her husband Randy co-manage an insulation contracting company here. Lori serves on the board of directors of Associated Builders and Contractors, and is also on the board of directors of Parents Incorporated, the nonprofit arm of the Division of Youth Services in Salt Lake County. Lori is a priest in the Salt Lake City congregation. Her husband, this is an interesting part, I think, her husband Randy is Roman Catholic, but attends the RLDS Church with Lori and the children regularly. And Randy is the stewardship commissioner for the RLDS Church in Salt Lake City. Being Catholic doesn't bar him from that. Our third panelist is Evangelist Nedra Troyer from Salt Lake City in the middle. The lady in red. No. Nedra grew up in a Protestant church, the Congregational or the United Church of Christ. And her brother, in fact, is a UCC minister. Nedra graduated from the University of Tulsa in education. She was ordained an elder in 91 and then an evangelist last year. In the 135-year history of the Salt Lake City congregation, Nedra is the first Salt Lake City person ordained to the office of evangelist or patriarch, whichever term you want to use. She has served as pastor of the Orem congregation. She has been a career woman in the field of marketing. She designs kitchens for people, and she mentioned that one of her clients was some guy they call the mailman around here. I don't know if he just brings good letters or what. She and her husband, Sid, have been leaders of the church in this area for some time. So without any further introduction, our speakers will speak in the order that I introduced.
Good morning. When I was thinking about what I would share with you as part of our sharing with you here today, the only thing that I could really think of is that I would like to share with you my personal journey or aspects of my personal journey in becoming a priesthood member and kind of what led me to accept my call. I want to say right up front that as long as I'm breathing, taking breath upon this planet, that it will be a journey. It is a process for me, and at no point is there an arriving place in my perception of being a priesthood member, but I am constantly involved in an ongoing process of becoming, of learning how I best can become Christ's eyes, hands, feet, mouth, and reflect his love in the world. So a servant makes mistakes, a servant like me makes mistakes, plays hooky sometimes, and even talks back a little. And perhaps I'm more human than most, but I'm trusting that God is, that's really all God is looking for anyways, for someone to be out there doing their best. How I got from where I was headed some 7 or 8 years ago remains to me in my, well, to coin a phrase from one of a movie that just came out recently, Shakespeare in Love, one of my favorite line is, I don't know. It's a mystery. And he would say that off and on, and it always was a mystery, and yet it always worked out. You couldn't tell how it was going to happen, but it always worked out. And that, for me, seems pretty much sums up the journey of my life. And the first aspect of it is kind of the mystery of answered prayer. I don't know how many of you have, I'm sure all of us, every one of you have, prayed for something and had your prayers answered in a way that was very different from what you had expected. Didn't look anything like what you'd prayed for. Well, that is basically the story of my prayer life. I can say that my prayers have been answered, but they always have looked very differently than what I had in my own little brain and what I had mapped out for myself. God's always so surprising, isn't he? And just downright tricky sometimes. My journey pretty much began the year that I prayed for humility. And if any of you have prayed for humility, you kind of know what I was in for after that. My life pretty well crumbled down around me, and I lost everything more than once in that year. And right at the point when I thought I couldn't get any lower, I got lower. And it was a time where everything in my life was being challenged and being split apart, and I was trying to make sense of it all. And in the process of it all, I finally just surrendered and said, okay, fine, I give up. You're in control. Just do with it what you will. After that, the next year, I continued to pray somewhat naive prayers, and I prayed for God's will to be done in my life and for direction. And it was that prayer that really brought me here where I am today. That prayer, combined with the one for humility, has guided me through many life decisions, big and small, including my decision and choice to be ordained and to serve Christ as a priesthood member. As Bill already said, that in our church, we have the ability, when receiving a priesthood call, to turn it down. And it's an opportunity for us to exercise our God-given agency, to examine our stewardship to God in many aspects of our lives, and to determine whether or not this is how we feel God calling us to serve. And it's not an easy choice to make. The only calls the congregation is aware of, or really anyone besides the pastor is aware of, are the ones that have been accepted. I could have said no very easily, and no one would have known. Nothing would have happened. I could have gone on my merry little way. And since not everyone receives a call to priesthood ministry, there was for me a definite realization that by my accepting the call, I was truly stepping forward and making a very personal commitment in a very real very significant way, saying that here I am, send me. I'm willing to serve. It's often said that being a member in the RLDS Church is really the highest office that anyone can hold. And I believe that is true. I believe that wholeheartedly. As a member, I was already serving in many numerous ways, in worship services, speaking, as district youth leader, helping to coordinate and start a food pantry. I planned and presided some services, sang, taught Sunday school. I was definitely as active as I ever wanted to be. And I didn't have the duties or the responsibilities that accompany a priesthood role. So I felt like I had a whole lot of freedom, you know. I was definitely having the cake, you know, in my mind. So when my pastor took me aside and said that he had been made aware of a call to priesthood for me, there were many concerns in my heart and in my mind that went running through me. And all of them have had or are having positive outcomes. So all of the concerns that I thought were huge mountains, now when I look back, you know, they're blessings in disguise, the challenges. The first and foremost concern that I had, and I made this a prerequisite with God right at the beginning. I said, okay, if I'm going to do this, this is one thing that I need to just state as a guideline right up front, that I wasn't going to change who I was. And that was that. A little naive there. But in my mind, who I was included a lot of different things. And it was important to me that I be able to still be who I was with the uniqueness that is mine and serve in this role. So I kind of said, God, you want to take me as I am. And fortunately, that's what God does to all of us all the time anyway. God had no intention of doing anything other than that. It took me a while to realize that God called me because of my uniqueness and my individuality, rather than in spite of it. My second concern was, in becoming an elder, is that I was concerned that in being an elder, I needed to learn to serve Christ in the same way that the other elders around me were serving Christ. And I did my best for the first few years to follow in their footsteps, and looking for role models and mentors that could help me along the way. And I found many good ones, but none of them quite matched my own particular viewpoint or my own particular individuality, my personality, just the way that I do things, my own particular ministry. So I felt like kind of like an imposter, like I was pretending at being an elder and didn't really know how to be an elder at all. And kind of when I tell you who my role models are, you might be able to figure out why. My biggest role model was my dad. Growing up, all my life, my dad was an elder. Ever since I can remember, he was pastor of the congregation and very involved in the church. My family was in the church. Every time the doors were opened, we were there, very active in everything. Well, I'm not my father, and there's no way I can be, although I have many wonderful qualities I get from him. I was kind of setting myself up for failure right from the get-go. Another aspect of this, and very related to this, is looking for women role models was rather challenging for me. At the time when I was ordained in Salt Lake, there were only a couple women priesthood members. There had been some more, but people come and go, and they had moved on. Some other members had moved on, and Nidra was one of them. And she was an elder at the time, I believe. But so there weren't a whole lot of role models available. And even the ones that were ordained hadn't been serving in their ministry for what you would call, a real long time. So just a matter of years as well for them. So that has been challenging. It's wonderful now to realize that our church has now two women apostles, and we can use them as women ministers, use them as role models as well. However, that's also very recent, and they're still finding their way in their own ministry in this new role as well. One thing that this has done for me is it has really challenged me to, rather than look at anybody else and pattern my ministry off of anyone else, it's challenged me to look inside my own heart and to really listen to what God is asking me to do and how God is calling me to serve and to uphold that and follow through on that. So that has ended up being a very, very strong blessing to me. Also, being single was a very big concern for me. I realized that being single, many of my needs, concerns, and challenges would be different from other priesthood members, and especially other women priesthood members who were married. Among some of my concerns in this regard were other people's perceptions of me. I needed to be very careful when I was ministering, especially, you know, ministering to a male member, just that there was no misconceptions or anything. And, of course, you know, whenever you're in a leadership role, you always need to be careful of how people are perceiving you. But I realized that that was something that I would need to be very aware of. Also, a support system. Being that I was living on my own, I needed to have a good support system underneath me and around me, a good system of friends and family that would be able to support me in my needs and be there when I needed, that I could call and say, hey, I've just got to talk about some of the concerns that are on my heart. And kind of going along with this is I realized I needed to learn how to say no. And I needed to really watch out for my own tendencies to overcommit to things and to get overenthusiastic and say yes to everything and then have overcommitted too much. One thing involved in that is that because there wasn't anybody else to help take up the slack at home for me, if there were any other deadlines or at work or anything else, I needed to be able to very clearly say that the things I said yes to were the things that I could do. I could do. Also, one thing as that I've learned to develop and that I have developed in being this is a sense of self-worth and a strong sense of self-worth in being single, in that it's a choice, it's no big deal. It's always kind of interesting to me that we call it a marital status. It's not necessarily my marital status. It's simply where I'm at in my life, and it's no big deal. Anywhere than where anybody else in their life is any real big deal. It's simply where you're at. And there are blessings and there are challenges all over. And none of them limit in the way that I serve. They simply help me find my own particular form of service. The reason why I said yes to become a priesthood member was basically, in a nutshell, I had an experience that told me in my heart that I knew that God was calling me to this. So when I received the call from my pastor, it wasn't a surprise. It was more like, yeah, you prayed for it, you asked for it, you knew it was coming, so now you have a choice. And I said yes. There's been many blessings in priesthood ministry that I've had, and I think the blessings and the benefits that I have received have far outweighed any service or any amount of ministry that I've been able to give. I feel much more on the receiving end than on the giving end, even though being a priesthood member is definitely a servant role in our church. I'm very aware that God has never left me, that God has been with me every step of the way, and present with me in my, when I felt the weakest and when I felt the most forlorn and when I felt like I knew the least about what I was being asked to do, especially the first time being pastor, there was so much I didn't know. And God was there with me every step of the way, giving me the answers almost before I even knew to ask. When the day was done and I went at home at night, sometimes I'd feel a little lonely, a little sorry for myself, and always it would come to me just the reminder of how very blessed I am. Another aspect of benefit or blessing that I've received from being a priesthood member is the opportunity to witness the face of God within so many different faces of other people in this life. And that has been a great blessing, just to witness so many different aspects of God manifest in this world. Also, the self-confidence to know that being a kumquat in a basket full of apples and oranges can be a really wonderful, fun, and uplifting thing to be, and very empowering as well. And when you realize that sometimes God calls you because you are a kumquat and has no expectations or desires for you ever to become an apple or an orange, but to simply bless and grace the world by being a kumquat. And that has been perhaps the greatest blessing of all for me. And it is carried over into my personal life as well, realizing that God is not necessarily calling any one of us to do anything in particular, but to simply be. And that being, for me, in my understanding, is being in a relationship with God and with myself and with others that truly reflects the love of Christ and the love that God has for each one of us. That is the being, and all the doing comes out of that. So you can be anything that you are in this life and be of immeasurable worth to God in His work.
I think you'll see right away that I'm a mango. Well, I think what you'll notice when you listen to the three of us speak is that we are all so different, and we all bring something. God has called us all for very different reasons, and we all bring something different to the place where we minister. And to be a ministering disciple of Jesus Christ is a privilege that I did not, at one point in my life, I just didn't dream would be something that I would be called to do. In fact, I was at Graceland College at the time that the possibility of women in the priesthood became a reality in our church. I think I must have been maybe a junior. And it happened, they always arrange that conference will happen during spring break at Graceland College. So I was on spring break and off doing spring break things, although I was in the Independence area, and I can remember going to the opening communion service because I'd never been to conference and I wanted to see what it was like, and there was a lot of excitement going on at the time because there was a lot of anticipation about the coming subject of women being in the priesthood. But I was very engrossed the rest of the week in spring break activities and had no idea what a blessing that event would be to me personally later on. Not only because 10 years later I would receive a call from the Holy Spirit asking me to be a servant, but offered me an example. But there would also be many women who offered me ministry in my life and offered me an example of focusing my life on other people. As Bill mentioned, I was raised in the Reorganized Church, and my parents have both spent many years offering ministry through peer service to those in need. And now that I reflect back, this process of preparing this talk has been very good for me, because as I reflect back, I realize that being a minister was a seed that was planted and nurtured in me by my parents, my church family, and by God since I was a child. And of course, I had plans of my own, and as a normal teenager, I felt an obligation to rebel and give my parents, my church family, and God a lot of worrisome moments. But when I now read the scripture out of the Doctrine and Covenants of section 119, all are called according to the gifts of God unto them, I am very aware that one of the wonderful gifts in my life has been the fact that I was placed in a family and church where service to others is seen as one of the greatest joys in life. And it is one of my greatest joys. About 5 years ago, my pastor called and asked if he could visit my husband and I in our home. And I knew before he came that he would be asking me to serve in the priesthood. I knew exactly why he was coming to our home. I knew this because the Holy Spirit had been quietly urging me, and I had been laying very low. But I also knew that whether I accepted that call or I chose not to accept that call, that my pastor would unconditionally love me and that God would unconditionally love me and accept me. But after careful contemplation, and because of the fact that I have received so many, many moments of grace in my own life, I discussed the commitment with my husband, not because I needed his permission, but because my husband and I are partners and we carry forward in everything we do together. I decided to accept that call to serve as a priest. That event has changed me. And recently, just a few weeks ago, we had an ordination service in our congregation. And the person who was presenting the talk asked a few of the priesthood members to get up and share their thoughts about being a priesthood member, which was kind of ironic because of this upcoming event. But my own father, who has been a priesthood member for many, many years, got up and shared that, and I too feel this way, that a call to servanthood and a call to the priesthood saved his life. And I know that accepting that call saved my life, because I could have easily taken a different path in life. But now, every day, in almost every choice that's before me, I remind myself that I have chosen to be a servant of Christ, and that greatly influences every choice I make. I must admit that sometimes I respond better than others, and God forgives me for that, I know that, and accepts my response when I am able to offer it. Now, how does priesthood translate into duties in our church and in my life? My family and I are regular church attendees, and that is very much by choice. We have the choice to go to church or not, and we go to church because it's where we praise God. It's where we renew our faith. It's where I gain strength. It's where I find peace. And I hope to teach others to experience some of those same joys. Some of the opportunities I have had include teaching adult classes on various topics, including scripture study, teaching children's classes, organizing youth activities, serving communion, which is a great honor. I occasionally prepare and present sermons during our Sunday worship services, ministry of presence, and if I listen, God places needs in front of me, especially when I petition him and ask him to place needs in front of me. However, a great deal, I can say probably most of my ministry, is outside of my church doors. I feel the Lord asks me to be a minister each day in many ways with many different people from all walks of life. I have a very special place in my heart and a love for service to the poor, to the common people. Through this service, my life has been enriched beyond description. Christ places me at the feet of many people, people who love him and teach me of his love. When my husband and I purchased the home we now live in, there was a woman there named Maria. She was living in that house, and Maria had been taking care of the gentleman who owned the home before we did. And when we looked at the home, the daughter of the previous owner was ashamed of Maria and asked her to go upstairs and hide while we were transacting our business of purchasing the home. We bought the home, but this woman kept coming back. She befriended us, and she urged us to be her friend. She is one of my blessings, straight from heaven now. I called this morning and shared with her, asked her permission to share this story. She had been in an industrial accident many years ago that caught her long, beautiful hair in a piece of machinery and completely scalped her. She suffered probably greater than any suffering that I've ever seen any human being experience. But I have never met another human who professes the richness and love of Christ more beautifully than Maria. She has shown me that to be rich is truly a state of mind, and that he who knows Christ is richer than all. Maria taught me about depending on Christ and his great love for me. In turn, that love fills my heart, and I am able to share with others Christ in them and help them recognize Christ in their life. As a minister, I hope I can see Christ in each person, in each of you. And I hope I can be an instrument in helping each person I come in contact find Jesus in their circumstances, in their own way of understanding. I could share many, many more stories, but I want to share just one other example of opportunity. Being a priest, one of my great pleasures, and as you know, priests are called to teach people to pray. And I am able to teach people to pray. From one adult, I can teach another adult. And especially, I get great joy out of teaching small children to pray. I work in the construction field, and the people I work with daily are hard-working, common, very wonderful people. About a month ago, I was visiting a job site around lunchtime where two of my associates were working, and one of them loves motorcycles. In fact, everybody that I know calls him Harley Dave. I offered to buy them lunch that day, and as we were visiting over hamburgers and French fries, I asked him about his young 2-year-old daughter. He loves this little girl more than anything and was sharing. And his exact words to me were, "The babysitter even taught her how to pray." And he said that he guessed that was okay, even though he didn't feel that prayer mattered one way or another, that it didn't make a difference. It just really brought to my face that every day God calls me and places people in front of me, gives me opportunity to show them of his ways and his ministry.
We have a kumquat and a what?
Mango.
A mango. I'm a kiwi. We didn't plan that, of course. I'd like to know, in this group of people, how many of you who are or have been members of the LDS Church have ever lived east of the Rocky Mountains? How many of you? Okay. And of those with your hands up, how many of you have attended a congregation that was not in a metropolitan area, more outside of the city? Okay. And of those with your hands up, I'd like you to tell me about how many people worshiped with you in that congregation. Do you have an idea of how many in that? 150? 200? 150? Any smaller than that? In rural areas? Well, I know that when I was growing up, and things have changed a little bit, I attended church occasionally with my LDS friend, and we had to drive 60 miles. And the town we lived in still does not have an LDS congregation in it, although we've had missionaries there over the years. But we drove 60 miles, and there was a handful of people. Maybe 25 or 30 people were there, sometimes 40. And it grew, and they would come from miles around. And in some ways, that reflects how the RLDS church is in Utah. We are a family church. We're very close-knit. We depend upon each other. I think some of it has to do with the circumstances change over the years, but in other parts of the United States, some of our congregations are much, much larger than they are here. And so when we have references to our ministry in Utah, it is substantially different than when I lived in Houston, Texas, and I was RLDS there, or Independence, Missouri, being RLDS there. You know, coming from congregations of 600 and 700 to our congregation here, which is our family group. And we feel that even some of our people who come once a year or twice a year or once every 5 years, if asked what church they belong to, they would firmly say, "Oh, I'm a member of the reorganized church." So some of our ministry here is different than it is in other places because We have smaller numbers of those who are ordained and called upon in times of crisis. I think we get a crash course in crisis here in some ways, because every family that's ever been connected with our church, when in times of need, usually call upon one of us. Now, some of us in this room who have been called upon for ministry, you'll never hear those stories. They're very quiet about their ministry. And we believe in servant ministry, and servant ministry is not glamorous, and it doesn't have a high profile, and it doesn't, there's not much said about it outwardly. And so sometimes when we share our personal, some of the stories that we have, these may be things we haven't shared with even our own congregation, because that's not usually what we do. Servant ministry is at the feet of other people. And because of that, and because my husband and I have chosen to be active members of the church, and we live about a block from the church building too, which makes our home one that's often called upon in different situations. Over the years that we have lived here, we've been called upon to work with many, 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 many families, and for much of that, it is in crisis, in suicide, in death of babies, in times when a mother dies and someone asks us to tell the children about it. It's in emergencies, it's in long-term, it's cancer, it's drowning. It's all the things that make up life. And if any of you have been on this earth very long, you know that's what life is about. It's a journey where the road is smooth sometimes, but not always. Also along this is great joy that we have in communicating together as a family church. We in the priesthood consider ourselves bivocational. Some people call us lay ministers, but I think that's a misnomer. When a person is called upon to accept a priesthood call, if they choose that path, then they will be expected to take certain kinds of institutional study, and that can be done when ministers come out here to teach the classes. We may go to Independence to take classes. We can do it correspondence. But not only are we expected to take a certain amount of classes before we are ordained, but as a continuation of our ministry, we are called upon. I hold a card that's in my purse, and I know that at any time in Salt Lake City or anywhere else, I'm accepted as a minister so that I can go into the hospital in shock trauma intensive care in the middle of the night, or into the newborn neonatal intensive care. I'm allowed to do that. And so it gives us the ability to go places as any other ordained minister would. We can legally perform weddings, and we, of course, do baptisms and funerals and other things that ministers do. As far as the role of what you might know as patriarch, we very strongly in our church are admonished to use the term evangelist. And evangelist is the term that our church chooses to use, has chosen over the last few years to use. But when I say the word evangelist, the interpretation might be patriarch. So you might know what a patriarch does in the LDS church, and I'm not sure of that either. Sometimes I use that term, particularly in this local area, because of that's what a translation is of what evangelist would be. I want to read to you a plaque that I received after taking the class and so forth in the study. I was then ordained, and this says the office of evangelist. We are servant ministers of spiritual vigor, having deep faith in God, serving with unreserved consecration and love for people. We are ordained to be ministers of blessing, responsive to the reconciling and redeeming influence of the Holy Spirit in the lives of persons, serving in multiple ministries according to the unique gifts and callings of each evangelist. Now, you're going to hear more than one calling. So it could be that an evangelist in the RLDS church might never give what you would call a patriarchal blessing. And then again, there may be one that does that all the time. There may be some that live there after the ordination until the day they die in this role and will never present an evangelist blessing. These are the four qualities: spiritual companion, apostolic witness, teacher-learner, so you'll see many of them teaching classes, and a pastoral presence. Our vision, responding to the Spirit of God, we will fulfill our calling as ministers of blessing, witnessing of Jesus Christ, integrating and empowering the church to meet the demands of the 21st century world, nurturing the saints in their spiritual growth, equipping one another for their unique services. We will seek to build up the body in the unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, so as to become mature to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. As part of the ministerial team, we will actively seek to integrate the ministry of the evangelist in the total life of the church as it extends Christ's ministry to the world. Now, if you translate all of that down, and some eloquent person said, you're the cheerleader. We don't necessarily get in there and play the whole game. We let the players play the game, but somebody has to be on the sidelines encouraging, bringing God's inspiration and concern to others. And so some have said the evangelist's role is that of a cheerleader. Evangelist's role is world. It's a world church calling instead of a local congregation. So an evangelist patriarch is called by the world church, by the one of the apostles. I'm going to go ahead and tell you a couple of things that I'd like to share with you, just some of the ministry that I've been privileged to be a part of. One of the experiences that happened that might be of interest to you, and I wasn't sure whether I should share this or not, take it or leave it. I was working with a person at the church one Sunday. We typically have a Sunday morning Sunday school and worship service, and then by about 12 or 12:30, then we don't have more meetings that day as a formal group of people. So I had set up a meeting with someone who wanted an evangelist blessing, and I was meeting with this gentleman, and we were at the church, and it was about 1:30 in the afternoon. Typically, there would be no one there at that time. So the phone rang during the time we were meeting, and I answered the phone, and it was someone wanting food from the food bank, and we're very actively involved in that volunteer work with the, what do they call it, this Utah Food Bank. And we deliver food. So I got a phone call, and they wanted some food. And I said, well, if you please, could you call back on the third week of the month and leave your name and information? And that was okay, and I hung up the phone. So we started talking again, and within a minute, phone rang again. And it was the same thing. We want food. And I said, well, would you call back the third week? And I was very nice. And then we talked for maybe 2 minutes that time, and the phone rang again. And they wanted food. And so I said to the other person, now look, if the phone rings again, I'm not going to answer it. And he said, okay. And it wasn't more than another minute, and the phone rang again. And I said, I'm not answering it. And it rang the fourth time, and he said, answer the phone. So I picked up the phone, and it was a gentleman, and he said, does your church do patriarchal blessings? And I said, yes. Do you have to be a member? No. Well, he said, I'm LDS, and I had a patriarchal blessing when I was a teenager, and now my circumstances have changed a great deal, and now I'm in my 30s. I have 5 children. I've gone through a divorce. My life has changed, and I really feel a strong need to have a blessing. And he said, it's not possible in my denomination to have another blessing. And he said, is there anybody that would give me a patriarchal blessing? Those are his words. And I said, how would you feel if that patriarch were a woman? Mm-hmm. And he said, was she ordained with somebody that holds the keys? And I said, first president of the church itself. He said, I have no problem with that. And I said, okay, then you're talking to the right person here. And we set up a time, and we met together on more than one occasions, because I feel that that's important to get to know the person. And he visited our church a few times, and he, in fact, did receive a very beautiful blessing, which was a written document that was mailed to him and so forth. And I think what's so ironic about that was that, first of all, for anybody to be at the church. Secondly, for me to be the one answering the phone. And thirdly, to think for 135 years, the answer would have been, no, we usually have evangelists that visit in the area and we set that up. But I could actually say, yes, we can do that. And that was a great blessing. And another thing that happened, I'm going to show you. One of the things that I like to do when I'm sharing in ministry is, if I know someone's in the hospital, I like to visit sometimes in the odd hours. And I feel like sometimes ministry is given sometimes in a very quiet setting that way. And recently, I went to visit a man. In fact, it was just last week. A man was in the hospital from out of state, and he's a member of our church, and he had some heart surgery, and he was supposed to be out of intensive care within 24 hours. 5 days went by, and his heart was still not beating regularly. So on the 5th of July, and you know what it's like in Utah on the 5th of July, it was the 4th of July celebration, and it was LDS Hospital, and Rice Stadium was having their big event, and this was about 10:15 at night, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to go up there. And I did. And I went into his room, I looked into his room, and he was sitting there, and his eyes were open, and it was about 10:30 then. And I went in and talked to him for a while in those quiet hours when the hospital's dark. And he was in intensive care in the room across from the nurse's station so they could monitor everything. And we talked, and we shared. And the next morning, and of course there were hundreds of prayers being offered for this man, but the next morning, he took a turn. It took a turn, and in 2 days, he was home. And I think of blessings like that are my own personal blessings. Another day, we had a lady in the church that found out on a Friday she was having some problems, and her daughter took her to the doctor, and he put her right in the hospital, St. Mark's Hospital, and this was Friday night, and on Sunday they scheduled her for a 5 bypass surgery. And Saturday morning, I woke up, my eyes just opened. It was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, what am I doing up at 5 o'clock in the morning? And I sat up in bed, and I thought, you know what? I had to go see Janice, and I realized she's a postal worker. She wakes up at 4, and she's at work at 5. She's got nothing to do today in the hospital except sit there and wait for tomorrow. So I sneaked on down to the hospital and kind of walked into her room. Boy, her eyes were open, and we probably had one of the best visits. For an hour, she talked to me and told me all kinds of things. Normally, I would not stay an hour. That's not a sensitive thing to do when people are in the hospital. But she wasn't in any condition she was feeling very good. Those are the kinds of things that we do. And in closing, I want to tell you a little bit of a story about a little child that I was working with one time. We had a member of our congregation, a little girl. I think she was 4 at the time. And she was at her grandmother's house on Christmas Eve, and her dress caught fire because of a candle. And she was burned. And they took her to the emergency room, and in fact, they did what they could and sent her home that night. And the following week, she was to go see the burn specialist to find out about transplanting skin on that burn, because it was very severe. And before she went to the doctor, her family called and asked for the elders to come in and give her what LDS might say a blessing. We would call it an administration. And where two elders come, and one usually anoints with oil and the other one confirms the anointing. And so the family has other children, so they had a counter in the kitchen, and they had the three girls lined up with Happy Meals in front of them. And my husband and I were asked to come and administer to this little girl. And so we did, and we came in, and we told her we were going to say a little prayer for her. So during the prayer, my husband did the anointing, and I was saying the prayer, and I was really into this prayer. It was very good, you know. And I was asking God's help, and I was just on a roll. And right in the middle, a French fries landed in my mouth. And over the shoulder, she had shoved a French fries in my mouth and said, "Hey, Miss Nidra, you want a fries?" And you know, you just have to be ready for this. And I reached down and whispered in her ear, "I'm going to finish the prayer first, and then I'll have a fry." And I did. And I thought, you know, that's the joy of the child, you know. And she wasn't worried. She was in good hands. And as ministers, it's It's not always that heavy trip we think it is. There's a lot of joy along the way. So I guess now we'll have questions and answers, so I'll let you take over.
Well, thank you very much. You did. Just one or two little footnotes for, I guess. Yeah, you just go ahead. Yeah. No, go ahead. I'll get my footnotes in later. Go ahead. Yeah. Okay. Well, I just want to mention that Diana's mother has been pastor of a congregation near my next door to my congregation back in Iowa. So she's a second generation female pastor in her family. Just one other thing, Michael Quinn. When the women were ordained in November of 85, then the RLDS World Conference Communion Service, which is such a major event starting the World Conference, is always on Sunday morning, and you know, many people attend, as Lori did in the previous year when she's a student at Graceland. Michael was in speaking to our John Whitmer Historical Association on Saturday night, and so he attended this first communion service where women served the communion. And Michael and I remember we were disappointed because we had a man serve us. But anyway, We were there the first time women served the communion at the RLDS World Conference. Okay, open to the questions. Yes.
Way easily overcome, or what? Mm-hmm.
Okay. So three questions he's asked. One is the nature of this training that we take for priesthood. Secondly, what's different about the RLDS Church that made this transition possible at an earlier date, possibly, than the LDS or whatever? Thirdly, then, what kind of problems were there along the way? And if any of the three want to address that, that's fine, and I'll jump in with one or two comments if they don't speak to all three of them. But if any of you want to speak to any one of them, just go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Can I speak to the third one?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. This is just from my own perspective, just as being ordained, when I was ordained, and noticing what had happened before as far as women serving in the priesthood. From our congregation in Salt Lake, I didn't notice any problems at all. There were some people that as a congregation, and when I was pastor the first time, that we were very sensitive to, that they may have a problem when it came to communion, you know, to have a man serve on the side in which they were sitting. But a few times, you know, down the road, we totally forgot about it, and there was no problem at all. The problem was more in our perception of it than in the person's response to it at all. And I think, in a way, there's been much more blessings than there's been problems. I think, from my perspective, just looking at it, I think men feel more freer to be more individual now than they did before as well. So it's opened and expanded the whole thing up, and has literally, I think, been instrumental in helping to transform a lot of different aspects of the church, just from adding that point of view, a different point of view in the leadership role.
Yeah. Something I'd like to add about that is, because of Nidra explaining to you the size of our church here, I think the men here welcomed and found relief in women's help, because anybody who's willing to step forward and serve Christ, we welcome them. Come help us. There is so much work to do and not enough hands, that I have never felt anything from any of the men that I've served with, anything other than welcome, open arms.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to say anything?
Mm-hmm. Well, if there's issues in a woman's life, such as child abuse, sexual abuse, other things, and they want to counsel with someone, and men would not be their first choice, there's another opportunity. When someone is facing a cesarean birth, when someone is facing a hysterectomy, when somebody is facing breast cancer and all the other issues of women, oftentimes, they're more comfortable having a woman to counsel with and to actually give prayers and other things. I don't know that I have found that to be, you know, across the board the case at all, but I know that there's probably some seeking ministry that they would have never asked a man just because of circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, the as far as difficulties, I think I'm doing a book on the split that's taken place in the church as a result of this these ordinations. And yeah, I think Salt Lake City and Utah have been fortunate that they haven't had the kind of problems they have in the Midwest. And I think maybe independent, maybe this is has something to do with the gathering, because in Independence area have by far the most vociferous opposition that has occurred. And many times when a woman, the first time a woman would preach to the congregation or even be up front, then some of the fundamentalists in the congregation would get up and walk out. And that had to be extremely hurtful, you know, to the woman that was getting up to preach or whatever. And I think I mentioned a number of the women were turned down in the votes of the state conference at the very beginning. But soon that was overcome, and I think everybody's been improved since that time. So a good friend of mine is now the pastor. I'll just briefly tell this story. I hiked for 3 days on the Mormon Trail with three RLDS women. They were all in the priesthood, and one of them was the pastor of another congregation, distant congregation that I happened to preach at the previous Sunday. And we pushed the hand cart and all. They had a great time. All four of us had a wonderful time. And as we're leaving, the kind of the patriarch of the group of two hand carts we were with set us down and popped the question. And, you know, I've had a good time with you folks. Why don't you join our could you join our church? And Pam Kleinfelter, the wife of our college president, recovered first. And she said, that Montel, that's nice for you to ask. You know, we probably should, you know, invite people more ourselves, our church and stuff. And then I said, we're all involved in our church, and we're all active in the priesthood. And I thought that would get the message across. And I forgot to add, Phyllis is pastor, you know, of those congregations. But anyway, he caught the hint, and he said, yeah, well, I guess it's not going to happen. But at any rate, some interesting comments, things like that have occurred. Why did the RLDS Church do this? Well, yeah, I guess the point I was going to make, independence, the more old-line, fundamental-type RLDS people have tended to gather in independence, and they have greater numbers, and I think maybe that's made it easier for them to organize opposition, like the type of opposition I mentioned. The priesthood training, typically these are 10-hour courses. You know, you spend 10 hours in training with, you know, the teacher if it's a residence, if there's a teacher and not individual study. Temple School and Independence, which many of you know Paul Edwards. For 15 years, Paul was the director of the Temple School, so they prepare the materials, send out the teachers, certify teachers, and so forth. And so it's through that that you get this certification. Next question. I was probably too long on that one. Next question from the floor. Bert. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know your name in the center in red.
Lady in red. Nidra. Nidra is my name. I almost wore blue, but I just knew it wasn't me. Okay.
So the question, for the tape purposes, the question is then, what are some of the feelings you have when as an evangelist you're giving an evangelistic blessing or having some kind of experience in which the inspiration is involved?
First of all, I want you to know that this the calling, which I've held this office less than a year. It was a tremendous surprise to me. And when I questioned the calling of my the president of the Order of Evangelists, I asked him, how can somebody of my age and my gender be a patriarch-type person? And I was in my 40s when I was called. And he said, you know, sometimes it has to do with life experiences. And it's what I said earlier about so many life experiences. And so as you accept a call, and as you begin to read and study, I think inspiration comes to you. There's, as one priesthood person eloquently put it, you have a heightened awareness. The more you practice something, the better you get at it. When I'm preaching a sermon, let's say, or speaking, they say speaking, you know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's medium. It's always entertaining, but it's not necessarily profound. When I'm preparing for an evangelist blessing, and I usually know the difference too, you know, but when I'm preparing for an evangelist blessing, I try not to space these blessings very close together. Because when I'm meeting with somebody and then preparing for their blessing, it's hard to focus on one person. So I always try to space them so they're not during the same week or something. And when I ask for inspiration, sometimes, and this may sound strange, but sometimes I'll ask not just for my higher power of God or Heavenly Father, as you might know Him, to lead me the right words, but I also might say, you know, if I were giving a blessing, what's your last name?
Silver.
I might say, Now, I don't know where you are, Grandpa Silver, up in heaven. But would you tell me, would you help me, would you lead me into the right words to say? Also, I call upon more than, I mean, I don't, that's just the way I do it. But when I begin to put the blessing together, and I prepare as much as I can before I meet with the person to actually give the blessing, I'm almost 100% certain. And when I begin to think about things like right now I'm struggling with one because I feel as a person I need to mention this person's upbringing and their past and the parents and how they treated them and so forth. I know now beyond any doubt that is not to be put in the blessing because I've asked over and over and over and I begin to form it. I use a word processor and actually form this and I every time I start to write I think no. I'm supposed to dwell on the future, not the past. This is not about the past. It's about the future. And if I put the past in there, even if it says the past is over and make way for the future, every time they read that blessing, they're going to say past. And it's going to be right there in front of them. So usually I know without any doubt at all. And I don't know what else to say about it. And people will read a blessing. It doesn't matter what you write. I mean, what they end up on the written page. They read it with the needs that they have at that moment. And over again, people have told me, I've read it one time, it's one wording, and it hit me there, and then 5 years later, I picked it up again, and it had a whole new meaning to me. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Maybe it helped, too, if you commented on what is the process. You've talked about the giving them a worded, written document. Is there an ordinance performed in which you speak these words to the person personally?
Okay, yes. When I meet with them, there's pamphlets that are printed by the World Church, and there are some things that I suggest we do along the way. I usually typically meet with the person 2 to 3 times, so the process may take, it may take a month, it may take a few weeks, it depends on what their deadline is. We are able to give a life blessing, we call it an additional life blessing. If somebody has had a patriarchal blessing in their past, they can ask for a new life blessing, an additional one as well. It's typically at a crossroads in your life, and so you come with other things to say. I have found that the process of when I listen, that part of what is happening during that life blessing is the person who gets to verbalize the things that are on their mind are probably made better if they never did get a written document. But there comes a time when we actually present the blessing, the evangelist blessing. That's done usually with that person and myself in a quiet setting, a private setting, and I place my hands on their head. The prayer is given. It's tape recorded, and then it's written in document form.
That helps out. Oops. Other questions? Mm-hmm. I mentioned that. Yes, go ahead, Ms. Beth Silver. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I do the transcription.
And do you ever feel impressed to do some revisions?
We are told, and of course I went to Independence and took the class under the presiding evangelist and so forth. We are told that we are human beings, and sometimes during that blessing we say human things like, a lot of that. We say the and we stutter, and there's long pauses, and we start a sentence and stop it and things. Yes, we can edit it to look better than how we sounded. Yes. Okay to do that, too.
Yeah, we even do that with the Revelations. Now, I was at Herald House in the early 60s, and about every two years I have a conference, and during those years there was almost always a Revelation. And it'd come over to Herald House to be printed. And Paul Wellington, the editor during most of those years, he said, you know, the document would come in, and sometimes there'd be a grammatical error in there, you know. So he might correct a grammatical error. My view was, his revelation is almost untouched. If it was something in the first presidency, Paul might tinker with it a little bit. Somebody on down the line in state is something for me or somebody else, I might get quite a bit of editorial.
Well, and you know your candidate, too. And if that, I mean, I know one recently, I knew I had grammatically said something incorrectly. It's what the world, most people wouldn't even recognize it. And I told the person, I wrote it as it was said. I know it's incorrect grammatically. Is that going to drive you nuts? And she said, yes. I said, I'll rewrite it. And I did one sentence. I changed.
Yeah. Okay, other questions, comments, responses? Yes?
I'm kind of at the process. Was this first introduced by the prophet?
Oh, okay. Yes, at the 1984 World Conference. Like I said, it was pretty common at most conferences. The president of the church, prophet of the church, would present a document. We typically label it a document at that point because it hasn't been approved yet. So he would present that, and then it goes, all the different quorums meet, you know, the 12 and the 70s and the high priests and elders and priests, and then they had, I think, also the members quorum or something. And so in these groups would discuss the document. And then in the general conference, you know, at the general business session, then all the different quorums would report their evaluation of it. I think, and you know, usually it's just routine because they've usually always been accepted easily. But in this one, I think there was one or two quorums that really had a pretty close vote. I think they all came in with a majority from their quorum, but some tight votes in some of them. And then the delegates as a whole then can discuss the document. And if I recall correctly, the document was presented on Tuesday morning, and it was like Thursday afternoon. You know, so there was 3 days of conference. We're pretty well devoted to that, and intense debate going on. Maybe a good step, the guy that's currently my pastor, when I didn't go to that conference. I missed the best one. I've been to most of them. I happen to miss the best one of all. But Jim, on Monday morning, I saw him having coffee at the faculty lounge or something, and I said, well, Jim, I knew he'd been a delegate, and we'd elected him a delegate. Well, Jim, did you vote for or against the revelation? And, you know, I was looking, and he said, I voted for it. And I said, well, anyway, he said, I was opposed to it on Tuesday when it came, but on Thursday when the vote was taken, I voted in favor of it. And I was thinking, oh, you chicken, you know, you just caved in because, you know, you didn't have a mind of your own. You know, the prophet said this is the way it's supposed to be, and that's how you voted. But then he said, I said, well, why did you change? And he said, the more I thought about it and prayed about it over the next 2 or 3 days, the more I realized the only reason I was against it was personal prejudice. And so he voted for it. So it was a good process, I think, for a lot of people to struggle, you know, with a really tough issue. Yes?
I just want to thank you for being there.
Well, that might not have been the reason. But
I had a daughter who was an elder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody want to comment? Okay. You know, on the World Conference in 96, when Grant McMurray became the new president and it had been announced by Wallace the previous fall that he was going to recommend Grant, I remember seeing some demonstrators out on the street. I thought, oops, we're going to have a fight here. But I think what really happened was most of the people who really would have been upset about not having a Smith had left the church because approximately, this is just a general unscientific estimate, but approximately one-fourth of the active members, maybe I said that in my introduction, had left. Well, those are the ones that would have been the hardcore opposers to a non-Smith. In fact, you know, when I talked, writing this book, when I talked to the fundamentalists, many of them will say, well, for now we just have these independent restoration branches, but we're waiting for somebody of a direct Smith line, you know, to be called to be a prophet. Boy, they're going to wait a long time. I think that's where they're going to have a hard time getting, you know, together. They're 200 different groups for the most part. But, so, yeah, so I think basically there's two strands in our tradition. One is it had been the Smith. That had gone back to 1912 when Joseph III chose his son Fred M. Of course, he'd been the son of Joseph Jr., but the other part of the tradition is the prophet had always selected his successor. So I think it's really the same as any other priesthood call. You know, the person in charge of this Salt Lake congregation has called several of these people here, and Wallace called Grant. It just didn't happen to be a Smith this time. For many of us, it's just a joyous experience. For me,
I think
a Smith.
A lot of people think it went father, son, and it did not. Mm-hmm. It went father, son, son, you know, I mean, and yeah. there are several mm-hmm. that have the same lineage as would be a son that could have been called. So, I mean, I think mm-hmm. it disturbed other people outside of our religion more than it disturbed yeah. us.
I don't think I'm not aware yeah. of anybody, a fourth of the active members left over the 84 revelation. I don't think a single person left the church. That's that on the women, yeah. Approximately a fourth of the active members of the church left and joined these separate groups. But I'm not aware of a single individual. Are any of you aware of a single individual who left over it not being a Smith? I think the hard-nosed Smith folks are off looking for a Smith somewhere, but not in our church anywhere. Paul Edwards is a direct descendant, but his name's not Smith. Yes. Oh, no. Yeah. In fact, go ahead. No. First non-Smith, non-descendant, go ahead, Diana, if you want to say something.
I was just going to say that it may be a break from how our tradition is perceived, but it's not a break in how we were told to select our leaders, and that is through the selection from the prophet. So in a way, it's not a break.
Yeah.
It depends on how you look at it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we had two traditions. We broke one, but we've kept the other one. It is a call. It's a call through the president of the church. Yeah, let me say something right here that might be controversial within our own RLDS church, and that is I like the fact that Grant McMurray's father was an alcoholic RLDS appointee. When they found out that he was an alcoholic, they kicked him out of appointment. His parents were divorced when he was about 9, and he grew up in a single-parent family with a lost alcoholic father. To me, that's made Grant a much more human person, and he's related to various problems that have occurred in the church in a much more human way, and I suspect there's a relationship there. You know, how many of our general authorities, your church and our church, are people who, you know, come from such difficult backgrounds? Tens, not too many of the general authorities have been divorced. I don't think we've had any have been divorced and so forth. Yes. The presidents up through Israel A. Smith, who died in 1958, served till death. W. Wallace Smith, his brother, and then his son Wallace B. Smith retired when they were around 70. Wallace, the recent one, a little younger than his father. One was over 70, the other was younger than 70. All of the apostles for quite some time have retired at a normal age in their 60s. Yeah. Well, since the 12 are appointed by revelation, I suppose you could say God, when God chooses somebody. In other words, traditionally it's been a revelation that has said, you know, Dwayne Cooey, you've served me well, and now you're ready to retire, and I'm calling so-and-so to replace you. So you could say that you're called by revelation and you're retired by revelation. When you're at the high levels like that where you know, we retire people. If you're just on these other offices, you serve in those offices as long as you're able to still be kicking, you know, and still breathe and so forth. Yes, I'm sorry I didn't call in earlier.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you think that maybe something else?
When I accepted the... Oh, did you want to repeat her question?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. She was asking if the calls to the ministry are lifetime or if they're limited duration, something like that.
Mm-hmm. When I accepted the call, my call to the office of elder, one of the things that I really took into account was the realization that this may be the office that I hold for the rest of my life. And is that an office that I feel, you know, would embody that? Am I capable of doing that? Am I willing to put myself out to be capable of doing that? And so I don't think there's any rule or there's any guideline about that at all. It's solely on an individual basis. And I know as a pastor, when I'm thinking of who... when I'm thinking of calls and being aware of calls, people being called to the priesthood, I take in account several things. I take in account, first of all, the very first thing is being made known of it by the Holy Spirit and having a testimony of that and seeing that evidenced in their life. Then I'm also thinking of the person as to whether or not they might receive that. Is this a good time in their life to receive that, and, you know, would they be open to saying yes? And then also taking into account the needs of the people of the congregation at the time in which they'd be serving. So there's three aspects that I take into effect. And anybody receiving, just from my perspective, anybody receiving another call to any other office of ministry within the priesthood would probably be dependent on those three things as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Brother Silver.
Well, at this moment, I hope none. I'm very happy where I am. I could spend my whole life being an elder and still only scratch the surface.
My dad was an appointee minister and feared that he might be called a patriarch and feared giving patriarchal blessings. He would wake up with nightmares that he'd been called a patriarch, but it never happened. Yes. Maybe that's why it never happened.
My question is sort of related to that. It's a sense of aspiration. Do people aspire to offices or engineering?
I don't see that.
We don't perceive any of this as hierarchy at all. You know, the ministry of a priest or a teacher is as fundamental as the president of the church, you know. It really is, and we don't look at it as any kind of, you know, higher or low, no advancement whatsoever. You're called upon by your gifts, and serving well in what you're called to do is really, really our important mission. And I don't know that anybody aspires to this. I mean, I don't see it.
I think we would say that that's not appropriate to aspire to so-called higher offices.
The question was, before there was ordination of women, did some? Yes, I think there were. And I think there were ministers, men, pastors, who were just wanting to call some women that just had that